Hello and welcome to Let's Brief It with your hosts, Niranjan Seshadri and Eric Tarasky. We are law students at the Georgetown University Law Center here in Washington, D.C. Today, we will be discussing the upcoming Supreme Court case between the Andy Warhol Foundation and Lynn Goldsmith. A photograph of the singer Prince is at the heart of the dispute. In the early 80s, Lynn Goldsmith took a photograph of Prince, which Andy Warhol then used as a basis for some of his artwork. He turned the photograph into 15 silk art prints. The question that will be decided by the Supreme Court is whether Andy Warhol's artwork violates Goldsmith's copyright. This decision could have far-reaching implications for social media and the arts. To discuss these issues and more, we are excited to have Professor Cristelia Garcia, a well-known expert in copyright law. She is currently an associate professor at the University of Colorado Law School. She holds a JD from Yale and a BA in economics from Columbia. Her academic work focuses on intellectual property law through the lens of law and economics. Welcome, Professor Garcia.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, welcome indeed. And thank you so much for joining us, Professor. To get started, could you tell us a little bit about what got you interested in intellectual property law?
Let's see. So I'd always been interested in the material that intellectual property law protects. I should say, like, I'm a big music fan. I used to be a DJ. I managed some bands in law school. So the music side came easily to me. And when I discovered that there was a body of law that actually aims to protect that, it was a pretty easy fit. And so I made moves to pursue that. And while I do intellectual property broadly, my focus is largely on copyright.
I see. And I should point out for our listeners who can't see your office background, but there's a nice display of vinyl records to really go along with the theme you just touched on. So I love that for the brand.
Thank you.
So in your scholarship, you write a lot about how law and policy address the competing interests of users and creators. The fair use doctrine is one of the most well-known limitations on copyright. Could you give us your perspective on how important fair use is for users and creators both?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as you noted, right, copyright's intended to give protection to certain types of works with the motivation to incentivize creation of those works for consumption by the public. And they, among others, right, there's like the first sale doctrine and so forth, but the really big check, if any, on this arguable little government endorsed monopoly on this particular item is fair use, right? And so there are different theories as to what fair use is trying to do. And I think really those theories are what's at play here in the Warhol case. No one disputes that fair use is intended to be an exception to copyright infringement. That we're all on board with. I think where scholars and lawyers and the parties in this case disagree is what fair use is supposed to be doing and when fair use applies. And so while the question is framed as whether a work is transformative, if it conveys a different message, or if it needs to, you know, be recognizably different, is all down to what you think fair use is supposed to be doing. One popular theory for what fair use is supposed to be doing, and one that I don't think is the only theory, but I think it is an important theory, is that fair use is intended to pick up where we see market failures, right? Of course, I would say that. And so that means that if there is a case in which in the open and free market, two parties came together and weren't able to reach a deal, maybe it's because there's something going on there that the market can't correct for, which means fair use needs to step in. And the quintessential cases of those are things like, for example, critique, right? Someone's going to write a criticism. So let's say Dr. Seshadri writes a book, and I want to write a review about how terrible the book is. And so I want to excerpt some paragraphs to point to this terrible prose. And in the market, there's no scenario, I don't think, in which he's going to agree to my use of his book in that way. And so fair use steps in and corrects for that shortcoming, right? And so we get enumerated categories, not exclusive, but, you know, among others, of things like parody and critique and commentary, right? That things that we need to be able to use. And then we have other exceptions like teaching and newsworthy events and things of that nature, right? And so in many ways, I think fair use is seen as a way to step in when the market isn't functioning in that way.
Thank you for that good overview on fair use. And it's a nice segue into my next question. You touched upon this, that there's a tension between the need to protect copyrighted material and allowing the public to use it, build upon it, and continue to innovate and create. The crux of the issue in the Andy Warhol case is the question of transformative fair use, which you also mentioned. The Warhol case involves a photograph. The last time the Supreme Court addressed this, the issue of transformative fair use, was in the context of a song. The rap group Two Live Crew composed a song called Pretty Woman, which was a parody based on the original by Roy Orbison. In that case, Justice Souter said that the more transformative the new work, the less will be the significance of other fair use factors, such as the effect on the potential market for copyrighted work. And the court held that the song by Two Live Crew was fair use of the original work. So my questions are, should transformative fair use be applied uniformly, regardless of art form? And the second question is, how do you think the Supreme Court will address the question of transformative fair use in this Warhol case?
Right. So to the first question, you know, should it be applied uniformly? I think it should be applied consistently, but almost certainly not uniformly, because every genre is so different. And in particular, and this is what makes these fair use cases, especially when they get picked up by the Supreme Court, so both intriguing and frustrating, right, is that they're so context specific that you worry that when they're making, you know, even in the Campbell case, like they gave this big, you know, the more transformative, this is the takeaway for my students, right? The more transformative, the less emphasis we put on these other factors. That doesn't mean the other factors aren't there and we don't need to consider them, just maybe they're less important, whatever less important means. In the context of a song that was inarguably a parody, which is one of the listed categories, right? And so will that same rationale apply if we're not talking about a parody or we're not talking about one of the enumerated categories? I don't know. And the courts, of course, never tell us. Now we come to Warhol and another really weird, uniquely positioned case about a photograph. And my thought really is not so much whether or not fair use should be applied in the same way in Warhol as it was applied in Campbell, but whether or not fair use is doing the same thing in both cases. I think it's not, right? And so I think in Campbell, it was correcting for a market failure. There was no way that Roy Orbison was going to license the song to this rap group that was known for its explicit and degrading lyrics to make a parody of his song, right? So that was a market failure. You know, that was, they weren't going to license it. And so we might say, well, then fair use can step in so that the public can, you know, enjoy the fruits of that parody. Here in Warhol, it's interesting that the question is framed as, you know, whether transformativeness will take the Second Circuit's definition or the Ninth Circuit's definition in a case like this, which is so clearly, to me, a case where the market functioned exactly right. And we know that because Goldsmith's photo was initially licensed and used for the exact same use that the Warhol Foundation is now licensing the photo for and licensing it, right? And so where there is a license, there is by definition a functioning market. And I don't know what fair use has to play here. I certainly understand where the petitioners are coming from. And there's a lot on the line. As you noted, one of the things I think is most important here is what the court might do. And this is, I think, what scares me and most of my colleagues, regardless of where we diverge on what fair use is supposed to be doing, is that the court will speak to this and potentially put a blur between the blur's already there, between when something's transformative and when it's derivative. And the import there for your listeners who aren't as ingrained in copyright as we might be is that derivative works are enumerated as one of the works that require licensing. And we think of, for example, if you take a novel and you turn it into a screenplay, that's derivative. And so the question on transformative is, if they define it in such a way that the line between transformative and derivative is further blurred, a concern might be that then we don't have a derivative work right at all, right? Then 106 doesn't give us that right anymore. On the other hand, and I think this is the argument that the petitioners have made and that some of my colleagues share, is that if the Second Circuit's position is upheld, I think their position's been, for what it's worth, full disclosure, a bit mischaracterized, but if it's upheld as misinterpreted, I'll call it, it could chill certain artists from creating because now they're worried that, you know, courts will be forbidden from considering the meaning and intent behind things. So it's a big deal for the court to address. And I don't even think it's so much whether the court needs to get it right as the court needs to not get it wrong, right? The less they do here, the better, in my opinion. I would only worry that they would, you know, go beyond the question and say us some other things that don't help us, as they have occasionally done.
I have a follow-up question to that. You mentioned that the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, they look at this issue a little bit differently. Is this the reason why the Supreme Court, after all these years, took up this issue of transformative fair use? Or is there something else that the court's interested in, perhaps coming up with a bright line rule for transformative fair use?
Yeah, ostensibly a circuit split's a really great reason to see the Supreme Court picking up a case like this. I think that's probably one of the largest drivers behind it. I also think that to a certain extent here, the question has been framed as not just a circuit split, but a circuit split between the two primary circuits who hear all of these cases and in a particular doctrine, namely the fair use doctrine, that has so much room for the court to do stuff, right? So a bright line rule, maybe that would be interesting and maybe antithetical to what fair use is supposed to be doing, but that doesn't mean that the Supreme Court, as currently composed, won't go for it. Maybe, I don't know. What's really interesting is this particular Supreme Court. We don't have Breyer anymore, right? And he was the copyright guy. And we don't have Ginsburg, and we sort of knew where her copyright jurisprudence was. Like, I have no idea where the copyright jurisprudence of this particular court is. You know, Jackson seems great, but I don't know what her copyright, you know, priors are. So again, I'm interested and slightly scared of what's to come.
Along those lines, you know, we were talking about the balance the court is going to strike and the fear of them, you know, doing too much. What impact do you think the verdict in this case is going to have for copyright creators and for users going forward?
Yeah. So I think that depending on how it goes, right, I guess I would hope that the court goes somewhere between the two purported views, right, that the petitioners are saying courts should always consider meaning and message and for that highly selected language in Campbell, where meaning and message equals transformativeness and where there's more transformation, then we care less about the other factors, that that's everything. My concern there is that that would really tear away at the derivative work right, right? And begin to introduce this notion that, like, well, if you don't want to license something, then you can just, you know, say it has a different meaning or message, and there you can put yourself under fair use instead of infringement of the derivative work right. That's one side. On the other hand, if they went too far the other way and adopted a view that, you know, you're forbidden from considering these things and you have to come up with, you know, transformativeness in a vacuum, potentially just looking at commercial impacts, for example, that could confuse artists, right? It could chill them. It could make them think like, well, you know, I don't know if this is a different purpose. And if it's not different enough, then maybe I'll get dinged for infringement. So I'm not going to create this thing. So I think, again, my hope is that they would go somewhere in the middle, which honestly is where I think we are, but maybe give a little more clarification on when fair use kicks in or not. I would love to see that have like a market base, but whatever base they pick, I think that could be, you know, anything that would help further clarify the lines, in my opinion, between transformative and derivative could be helpful both for the purposes of artists understanding what they can do and for the purposes of knowing when you need to seek a license or not. So we'll see. I've seen the briefing on both sides. It's excellent. So I'm hoping that it's good enough that it kind of pushes them into a narrower final outcome.
You know, as someone who kind of uniquely straddles the line between the legal world and the artistic world, given the description of your background you gave us earlier, I'm interested in this case about the role that judges should play in evaluating and critiquing art when it's in question like this. And I know Judge Lynch, I believe writing for the Second Circuit, said that, and I quote, "The district judge should not assume the role of an art critic and seek to ascertain the intent behind or meaning of the works at issue. That is so both because judges are typically unsuited to make aesthetic judgments and because such perceptions are inherently subjective." I think that the judge's words there make a lot of sense. I certainly, as a, you know, prospective lawyer and law student, do not feel in any way qualified to be making judgments about the merits of different pieces of art. But I'm wondering, regardless of how the court comes out on this, how you think going forward, judges should insert themselves or not into making judgments about the artistic value or nature of a piece of work brought before them on a copyright action.
Right, right. That's an excellent question. And I think that the judge in that district court had the right idea, namely that, you know, everyone works in their area of competitive advantage, and judges' competitive advantage is certainly not art assessment, more particularly art, you know, the divination of art's meaning and message. In fact, in some cases, it could be even argued that the artist, and I think Goldsmith raises this at a certain point, doesn't necessarily need to be the final arbiter of what the art means or what its message is to the people receiving it. So a lot of this depends on, like, who are we asking? What the artist's original meaning was, what the audience took the meaning to be, who the jury thinks, the judge, whatever. The other thing, and this is more from a sort of evidentiary logistics side, and I think the judge brings this up as well in the case that you were quoting, is how do, you know, they could say anything is the meaning or the message. There's no evidentiary way to prove that that is or isn't the case. And again, to me, that's just problematic when it comes to the derivative work, right? Because arguably lots of changes, substantive changes are made between a novel, say, and a screenplay, and they could be argued to have, you know, different meanings and messages even, right? Or you could say they have different purposes. One is for reading, one is for film, or they could have the same purpose because they're both for entertainment. So now we're just getting into lawyering, right? Like, what do we think the purpose is and what do we think the meaning is? So I wouldn't take any of it away, but I certainly think it's true that one of the big challenges for fair use, its strength and its weakness is its subjectivity and the way that we've got these four different prongs that could go all kinds of ways. And, you know, I think the best we can hope for then is that we get these juries who are hearing everything and making some reasoned decisions. There is some risk of a judge doing it just because I don't think the judges have any particular training in divining art meaning and message.
You mentioned a little while ago about how the copyright expert on the panel, Justice Breyer, retired, and we don't have Ginsburg anymore, unfortunately. So, given the current composition of the Supreme Court, and they seem to be leaning more towards textualism, originalism, with the copyright having its origins in the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of the Constitution, does that have any role to play in how this case might come out?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that. And as is the case for so many of the recent decisions that have come down, you know, I think it's a bit some of those are more predictable than others. This one, I actually think it really depends, because a textualist view, on the one hand, if they're looking at Section 107, right, or a combination of Section 106, where we've got derivative works listed, 101's definition of derivative works with 107, fair use, could lean in something really narrow, right, which would be, in my opinion, good. Like, there's one place where I'd say, let's look at the text. On the other hand, if you follow the briefs, a lot of this rides on, as I'm characterizing it, a disagreement on what Campbell says, right? Whether Campbell says transformativeness hinges on purpose and character or intent and meaning, which, you know, this is lawyering again, but arguably intent and meaning is, as Mr. Trotsky was explaining, something that maybe judges shouldn't be messing with, whereas purpose and character, it's been suggested, could mean, let's see if this is something that they could have just licensed, right? Is there a commercial angle? Not determinative, but it's there. And so if they go into the language of Campbell, it will be interesting to see, applying that sort of textualist view, what they think the text says. I mean, the words on the page are purpose and character. They're not intent or meaning. So that would seem to say they might lean towards the respondents. But, you know, with this court, you just never know.
We briefly talked about the question of derivative works as well as transformation. Section 101 defines a derivative work as something that recasts, transforms, or adapts pre-existing copyrighted work. One of the areas that was a little confusing to me was transformation as a derivative work versus transformation in relation to fair use. Is there a difference between the two?
I mean, that is the question, right? And I think that, you know, I always tell my students, there's a fine line, right? If you are riffing on something and you need to get a license for it, then it's derivative work. But if you're riffing on it so much so that it creates this entirely new thing, then maybe you can, you know, push yourself out of derivative works and into fair use. You know, and that's like a super oversimplified way of explaining it, but like a little bit different derivative, real different transformative. But then we get this case like Warhol, and, you know, the pictures, and, you know, if your viewers have not seen the print series, you can look them up, and then you can look at Goldsmith's photo, and they're different. And, you know, maybe this is a really subjective analysis anyway, but like, how different are they? Are they a little bit different? Like, did he tweak the colors and like play with the eyes, or did he do this like completely transformative pop art thing? And I think, and again, the problem with these sorts of analyses is that's so subjective, right? Great and honest people who can see and are thoughtful could come to different conclusions on that. And so maybe that shouldn't be the be all end all. Like, maybe we should also consider other things. Again, this case being particularly quirky, such as the fact that they thought it needed a license and so they licensed it, right? Like, that's a pretty good sign that they thought they had a derivative work on their hands.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was interesting in terms of how this whole issue came to the fore was initially Lynn Goldsmith took this picture of Prince and it appeared on a magazine cover. Mm-hmm. And then Warhol took that picture and 4 years later created 15 tile art pieces of artwork. And Vanity Fair wanted to license Warhol's work to commemorate Prince's death. And that's how this whole issue came about. So if that was not the case, would this have been such a big issue?
Right. Well, potentially, if they hadn't gotten the license from the Warhol Foundation to put the picture into the Condé Nast, you know, anniversary of Prince's death issue, we might not be here because Goldsmith wouldn't know about it, right? I mean, this print series was created, you know, almost two decades ago, and she didn't know about it. So she only found out about it when it came to. They'd been selling, by the way, for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in galleries, but that's just not where Goldsmith runs, apparently, nor where I run, right? So she didn't know. And, you know, I didn't know, maybe I knew, but, you know, so that drew her attention to the works. And to be clear, she didn't say that she owns the copyright in Warhol's works. Rather, she said, those are derivative works. And the reason I think they're derivative works is because the other one he made, he licensed from me. And then he exceeded that license. I mean, this is her argument, right? And made all of these other ones, which should have been paid for accordingly. And then he can license them all he wants, but he would have paid me for the derivative rights and he didn't. And so these are infringing works and therefore you can't license them.
So finally, do you have any advice for law students who are interested in intellectual property law?
Gosh, yeah. Well, I mean, so listen to this podcast and ask lots of questions. Maybe get involved, you know, take the classes, right? If you've got a copyright class and a trademark class or an advanced seminar in whatever floats your boat, you know, try to do that. If you're in a place where you can, you know, get exposure by going to events, you know, an organization like the DC Bar, in this particular field of law, an organization like the Copyright Society, for example, will hold events that are often student-friendly or offer reduced rates for students to go and hear practitioners talking, so you can get a better sense for like what it is that one could do in this field. I think that's a great way, plus some networking, right? Because these people work at places that hire people, and that's what a student may eventually want. You know, there's also in this particular area of the law, copyright, like there's so much always happening that's in the popular press that even following, you know, vanityfair.com or billboard.com and blogs, right, that are about sort of, you know, the fashion industry, are great ways to sort of, you know, take a study break and read something interesting and also help to formulate ideas about like what's going on, what sorts of questions are pushing the envelope like this one in the copyright world.
Professor Garcia, thank you so much for graciously spending your time with us here today. Thank you as well to all of our listeners for tuning in for this first episode of season 4. We hope that you enjoyed the discussion and learned something new, as I know I did. We will be back soon with another episode of Let's Brief It. And lastly, we would like to give a quick shout out to our wonderful sponsor for this award-winning podcast, the George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. Thank you all, and we look forward to welcoming you back next time.
The D.C. Bar Law Student Community strives to engage and support law students before you graduate and expose you to the tangible benefits of joining the D.C. Bar and D.C. Bar communities. Curated programming allows law students to participate in substantive content programming, leadership trainings, networking with practicing attorneys in fields of interest, writing opportunities, and other activities designed to expand your legal education beyond the classroom. Make an investment in your legal career by joining the law student community. To learn more, visit us at www.dcbar.org or email communities@dcbar.org. We look forward to hearing from you.